The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com/PEL to get $5 off your first order.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 142 might either be what is love or what is rhetoric or possibly something else. And the source of this confusion is our reading today, Plato's dialogue, The Phaedrus, probably composed around 370 BC. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintonmeyer, energized by but not overwhelmed by love.
Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Allwyn, sowing the garden of this podcast purely for amusement in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey, taming my horses in Middleton, Wisconsin.
And this is Adam Rose joining in for the first time from Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome, Adam. Cool.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So Adam is here because we are doing kind of a partnership with his company, The Great Discourses, to provide some additional offerings through Not School, one of which will be a course related to this dialogue, right?
Yes, we're going to be doing a course starting in July on Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, actually in conjunction with Plato's dialogue, Phaedrus.
So that is very, very soon, starting after when this is posted. So hopefully people have heard about this on the blog, but you can sign up right until the first day, right?
Yes, you can sign up even on the first day or even after the first class is over if you want.
So these are seminars, they're short term.
Basically, what we're doing is using online web conferencing technology to reduce the barriers to access so people can participate in live interactive discussions about classic texts with professional educators and other intellectually curious adults around the world. And so it's a chance to master some challenging classics, have some great discussions, and actually meet some great people that you probably turn into some good friends.
All right. So the plug is over. But now the normal sort of show the audience who our guest is. So you've been teaching for many, many years. Was your background in rhetoric rather than philosophy or literature? What, where are you coming from for this?
Well, kind of ironically, like the Phaedrus, I've got two halves to myself. In my first life as an undergraduate, I was a software engineer, and I actually worked in the computer field for about a dozen years before I had an early midlife crisis and decided to go back to graduate school and start pursuing the humanities and the social sciences. And so I did graduate work in the humanities and also in the social sciences. And it's through that that I became a teacher in a great books program at the University of Chicago, where I've been teaching for over 20 years.
And you had mentioned kind of wanting to get at the Platonic dialogues from a literary dimension, that that's been the focus of your studies for them before. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do when, you know, my understanding of working with classic texts is to try to take each text on its own terms. And when we look at Plato, for example, they kind of seem self-evidently to look like plays. I mean, they look a lot like scripts for plays. And so if we follow where that leads, it can lead into the kinds of analysis that we would actually do with plays. It doesn't mean ignoring what many people would call the philosophical content, but it means also looking at dramatic elements of the stories as well.
Yeah, and there's actually a lot in this particular reading which speaks to that idea. If you're going to say something about the written word, and there's talk at the end of the Phaedrus about being playful or whether or not to take what's been written seriously. So it's a good dialogue for having that discussion.
Yeah, and I think above and beyond even just the pure playfulness is the question of whether or not the dialogues in general, or this one in particular, should be treated as pieces of rhetoric, and that should not be held against it, that the text is actually trying to do something to the readers, which is what rhetoric is intended to do, in addition to possibly describing something about the nature of the cosmos or the nature of the soul or love or so on.
So am I right in thinking that Dylan and Wes, you both did this at St. John's? This was my first time reading this, so I might be the only newbie.
This is the only book at St. John's in the seminar that's read twice. It's read as the very last dialogue of your freshman year, and it's read at the very last seminar of your senior year.
It's like that old TV show Kung Fu, you know, when you can take the pebble from my hand, it will be time for you to go.
Wes, what was your background with this?
Well, I did theoretically go to St. John's and read this twice, but it might as well have been for the first time. It's been long enough.
Yeah.
folks that have listened to our older episodes, we already did one on the Symposium, which is also about love. We did one on the Gorgias, which is also about rhetoric. And we do get some, not exactly rehashing, but some development. It's unclear with all these, which was written first, which was written second. Doesn't really matter. They're not identical. When I was first going through this, I was feeling like, rehash. I already know about this. I know basically what his take on love is going to be. I know basically what his takes on rhetoric is going to be, that the rhetors, is it rhetors or rhetoricians?
I like rhetoricians.
Or rhetorician? Yeah.
Rhetorician.
I like that better because rhetorician sounds like you study rhetoric. I don't know.
It sounds like you've rhetorically inserted an extra syllable into the...
The rhetoricians, he's going to think, are frauds in some way, right? They're the sophists, people that argue in courts and they don't care about what the truth is. So to do it right, you would have to add some philosophical element to it. And love, we saw in the Symposium, several different characters putting forward ideas about love. And for him, well, the platonic love, that phrase that everybody knows, it's not going to be based on desire. It's not going to be based. It's going to be noble somehow. It's going to have to do with seeing truth, with seeing the forms.
Well, wait, Mark. It's completely based on desire. I can't let that go by.
All right. Well, it's not going to be
completely based on desire. And so
it's not going to be based in animal and sexual. That's what the platonic love
He uses
means.
Sexual imagery the whole time.
But also we get at this towards the end, but there is a sexual version, which he doesn't think is all that bad, right? At the very end, when you give in to your lover, potentially there's just making out, or potentially there's also sex. But either way, you're elevated if you have the right kind of temperament and your beloved has the right kind of temperament.
The best kind of love is going to have no sex. Is that the two of you can resist that urge and just be energized by each other.
Well, he doesn't say that, though. He says you will give in to some extent. We'll get to that in the text, but
all right.
There's no version of it where you do not give in to some sensual aspect.
And then the third theme, which is the thing that I had heard about this, I thought this was going to be about language. And it turns out, yes, okay, there's this, what is rhetoric, but there's nothing about like what makes a word referred to this as opposed to that. It's not that kind of discussion of language, but there is some discussion at the end, which I think is what Derrida riffs off of. We'll eventually have a Derrida episode, I think, focusing on this. We had a guest that wanted to do that about whether what's better, spoken language or written language. And you could tell that Socrates, given that Socrates didn't write anything down, probably thinks that spoken language is better. So we can say a little about why that would be and if that casts a pall on the entire project that we reading the classics.
There's really three main questions at work in this dialogue, right? One is whether or not love is good or bad for the beloved if they give in to the lover's advances. The other is whether rhetoric is a good or a bad thing. And then the other is whether written speeches are better than real speaking between people.
On the one hand, I think you can say Phaedrus is to some degree kind of a mashup between the Symposium and the Gorgias. Plato has talked about a number of these ideas in other dialogues. But I think rather than approaching this dialogue and the idea, okay, I've seen this movie already, like why am I here? Why am I reading this? Perhaps it's more helpful to think about Plato as kind of working with a common vocabulary of ideas that he mixes and matches and deploys in different ways in a variety of dialogues so that things that he's treated in the Gorgias, for example, which is like public rhetoric, speaking before large crowds. Well, sure, in the Phaedrus, we're dealing with rhetoric, but one of the unique features here, I think, is that we're dealing with private rhetoric, rhetoric between one person and another. In fact, between a lover and a beloved. So yes, it's on the one hand, Plato's treated this before, but now we're actually in a new place with it.
And also there's, you know, the other part of this is all the connections between rhetoric and love, between those two ideas, which for the most part he doesn't make explicitly, but there are lots of playful, unexplicit and like conceptual connections that you're supposed to, as a reader, work out for yourself.
And it also means right there implicitly from the beginning in the idea of a lover trying to convince a beloved, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Persuasion.
Persuasion right from the beginning, and whether you should give into that persuasion and what that means and what kind of persuasion is the right kind of persuasion.
Right. So when you look at this dialogue in terms of language, it's not talking about linguistics in that sense, but more along the lines of the use and abuse of words or the use and abuse of speech.
Mm-hmm.
Now, structurally, Adam, what you're saying is this is a mashup of the Symposium and the Gorgias. The first half is like the Symposium, and the second half is like the Gorgias, in that the first half is about love, and in the Symposium, you got all these different speakers five or six different speakers.
One of whom is Phaedrus.
Yes.
It's introduced by Phaedrus.
Here, there's only two people in the dialogue, but Phaedrus brings along a speech of Lysias, who's a famous orator of the time, and some of his speeches are apparently actually preserved, so we can go read some yourself. And Phaedrus reads this verbatim, and according to something I read, it's supposed to be Plato is giving kind of a satire of the type of speech that this person actually gave. So that's one of the voices. And then Phaedrus thinks that, oh, wow, this is a really great speech that I just heard. Here, I'm going to read it to you. Socrates is not sure that's that good. He thinks maybe he could do better. He actually gives an improved version presenting the same position. So it's sort of an elaboration. You can see the Lysias' speech and Socrates' first speech as a unity. But Socrates is showing this is not just different views about love. This is really demonstrations, this first half, of different kinds of rhetoric, different approaches to rhetoric. And so Socrates is trying to give a more systematic version, a better version of the same argument that was in Lysias' speech. So that's the first two things. Those are both against love, saying it's actually better to be a non-lover than a lover. But Socrates, after he's given that speech, says, oh, that's not really what I believe. Let me repent. We've been slandering Eros, who is a god after all, by talking about love this way. Let me recant. Let me give another speech, which is in praise of love. And he gives it in a mythic form. So he tells this whole long story. And this is, that starts with the whole, here's what the soul is. Here's why it's immortal. Here's kind of a picture of how the afterlife and reincarnation works. And all this eventually, with an image about a charioteer and all this, it gets to giving a picture of what love is and how this works with the human soul, how it's a matter of a certain balance of the faculties, which has some interesting connections with what he had to say in the symposium, but it's not the same.
The idea is he can use all that to support the idea that the beloved is actually improved by the lover rather than harmed.
Yeah.
Yep.
You're using all that to try and get at the effect of the lover on the beloved and to reverse that initial thesis that was Lysias' thesis that the beloved is harmed.
Do we want to just work through it? Or Mark, were you summarizing because you wanted to skip ahead to something?
I don't want to skip ahead. I was just trying to give, I think it's hard to give a high level overview of this dialogue. And so I was just trying to say, here's what the structure is. We got three speeches at the beginning. That's the first half. The second half is more of your typical dialogue where they talk about rhetoric and end with the thing on writing. There, end of summary.
Restating what you said in the terms of the dialogue, the first half of the dialogue consists of three specimen instances of rhetoric. So contrary to most Platonic dialogues, there's not dialectic. They're not having a discussion. So you've got three specimen pieces of rhetoric in part one that then serve as examples to be analyzed dialectically in the second part of the dialogue. So it's like if I'm trying to explain something to you, but we don't have any examples, it's very hard to do. So this dialogue very conveniently provides us with the examples at the beginning and then allows those to serve for the analysis that begins in the second part, which then leads from the analysis of those particular speeches to rhetoric in general that doesn't have anything to do with those particular speeches.
Yeah, I think a lot more time is spent on rhetoric in general. There's some slamming of Lysias. You would characterize the entire dialogue as being just a debunking of a popular orator and this whole mode of composing speeches as being really unprincipled and disorganized. And even though Plato's against rhetoric, he could still write a better rhetoric textbook than these guys did. Because once the Lysias is dispensed with, I think maybe implicitly there's, talking about it like I did as a myth, that could work. But there's not even explicit reference that I recall to like his own third speech, which is by far the longest one of the three, to say, see how I did it there? See how that was better than Lysias? Like, it moves just on to, what do the rhetoricians say about...
The implication is that his speech is in touch with the truth, right? That's going to be the distinguishing characteristic between rhetoric and the pejorative sense and rhetoric. If there is a non-pejorative sense of rhetoric, right, it involves not just persuasive techniques, but also the use of those persuasive techniques to communicate the truth.
And it's also, in being persuasive, it's persuasive for the good of the one being persuaded.
Well, and it's persuasive in pursuit of showing people the truth. And I think that's where, this idea, I think popularly that Plato is against rhetoric, and you certainly see that in a number of the dialogues. But I take, my understanding of this particular dialogue is that it's not anti-rhetoric. Actually, this whole dialogue in some way is geared towards showing the possibility and perhaps even the necessity of a genuinely what you might call science or art of rhetoric, which perhaps Plato thinks is not being practiced by anybody prior to his time. But I think the dialogue suggests or even states that such an art of rhetoric is possible and perhaps even necessary.
And involves the use of mythology.
Yep.
It seems to involve at least two things, that the person who's going to make these set speeches, whether orally or in writing, has to, on the one hand, know the truth about what right. he or she is speaking about. But second of all, you have to know the truth about the human soul and the types of human soul so that you can address your particular speech appropriately right. to the particular soul you happen to be talking to at the moment.
Right.
Yes. And from there, the criticism of writing follows very directly. Writing is not addressed to anybody in particular. Anybody can read it. And so it's not going to have that directness that good rhetoric would have. If the people you're talking to have questions, the document is not going to answer their question. Whereas in an oral form, you can do that. You can fill right. in the gaps.
You can't tailor a piece of writing towards your audience, which really comes down to a particular person. Every person is different.
Exactly.
And it may not even be the case that they should even hear a communication, right? So that yep. not everyone has the type of soul where you should talk to them about certain things. What I was mentioning with the mythology is that early on, there's this seemingly a throwaway point. So 229D, we get this talk of people who sort of want to deflate mythology. They want to explain it away. So for instance, if I disbelieved as the wise men do, I should not be extraordinary. Then I might give a rational explanation that a blast of Boreas, the north wind, pushed her off the neighboring rocks as she was playing with Pharmacia, and she is referring back to Orithaea, and that when she had died in this manner, she had said to have been carried off by Boreas. But I, Phaedrus, think such explanations are very pretty in general, but are the inventions of a very clever and laborious and not altogether enviable man, for no other reason than because after this, he must explain the forms of the centaurs and so on and so forth. So he has, you could spend your life trying to explain away mythology and miss the point, that those myths aren't meant to be literally true. They're meant to communicate something. And so you don't actually interpret myths by giving them some literal naturalistic reading, but you actually have to engage in the art of interpretation. And I think he calls back to this. This little passage is sort of indirectly called back to numerous times in the dialogue. And I bring it up just because we were thinking of Socrates' last speech as an example of rhetoric and how highly mythologized it is. And so this is one of the, I think, strands here, is the importance of the use of something like mythology rhetorically.
That's a really good section, Wes. And I just wanted to point just a few lines later, right at 2:30, after he says that he doesn't have the time to do this sort of infinite inquiry. I myself have certainly no time for the business, and I'll tell you why, my friend. I can't as yet know myself, as the inscription at Delphi enjoins, and so long as that ignorance remains, it seems to me ridiculous to inquire into extraneous matters. Consequently, yep. I don't bother about such things, but accept the current beliefs about them and direct my inquiries, as I have just said, rather to myself, to discover whether I really am a more complex creature and more puffed up with pride than Typhon, or a simpler, gentler being whom heaven has blessed with a quiet, untyphonic nature.
Let me give you my translation of that, because it's such a great part of that passage. So he investigates not these things, but myself, to know whether I am a monster more complicated and more furious than Typhon, or a gentler and simpler creature to whom a divine and quiet lot is given by nature.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of the great things about this dialogue, and when we get into Socrates' second speech, is that actually knowing who you are actually in some ways requires knowing the cosmos as a whole and your place in it.
Yeah. You're reminded of his scientific inquiry and the fundamental importance of mathematics and geometry for Plato as part of that.
But you get here also, you're shown the path towards a certain type of interpretive strategy. I don't ask whether there is such a thing as Typhon, right? I'm not interested in the literal truth of Typhon. I'm interested in comparing myself to Typhon and the implications of that. I'm interested in the interpretative possibilities I can use Typhon for.
That's interesting because if you have read the dialogues, and we'll see this again, he is constantly referring to the gods and talking about being godlike or not godlike, but taking for granted some kind of fairly typical understanding of what the gods are. And like you just said, Wes, aligning his own soul against that, or people's souls, human souls against that. And not worrying, if Olympus exists, where could it possibly exist? And how can Zeus hold on to those lightning bolts when they destroy everything around it? I mean, there's none of that kind of discussion going on. That's not the inquiry at hand.
Right. At the very end of it, he'll associate that kind of literalness with the act of writing, that kind of lack of playfulness over seriousness with what goes on when something actually commits something to paper. It lacks the possibilities of metamorphosis, let's say, the spoken word between two people.
That insistence on that playfulness and almost a kind of mysticism about it is utterly serious.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the paradoxes that I've repeatedly come across in reading Plato, reading about Socrates, is that I think, you know, the normal way of thinking about Socrates is that he's the paragon philosopher. He's Mr. Rationality incarnate. And yet I think we see time and time again that Socrates thinks that reasoning is actually plan B, that plan A is actually having direct access to the gods or being a god. But for those who don't have that, the best we can do is reasoning, and there really isn't any plan C.
And it's not communing with nature, for sure. Also, just in the section 230D, right after this, he's talking about they're in a nice outdoor location for this by that rock that they're talking about. Did the myth happen here? Did the north wind take this woman? And so right after that, Phaedrus is saying how little Socrates gets out of the city, and he says, "Forgive me, best of men, for I'm a lover of learning. Now then, the country places and the trees are not willing to teach me anything, but the human beings in town are." So just to contrast with Thoreau or something.
Yeah, this is the only dialogue that's not in the city, actually.
Right, and I think, but here's a nice way in which, you know, if you interpret this dramatically, it seems that one of the parallels that's being set up at the beginning is that Phaedrus has a chance, an opportunity of either taking a walk in the city among the colonnades or walking out in the country. And it seems to me that this is Plato's way of kind of, again, introducing the concept of doing something that's more ordered versus something that's a little bit more wild and unpredictable, and that that walking in the city is more comparable to producing these kind of set speeches, whereas walking in the country is kind of like doing dialectic. You just never know where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
The way the dialogue begins, Phaedrus says something to the effect that, so Socrates meets him coming from Lysias and then taking a walk after he's been with Lysias.
On the recommendation of Acumenus, who's a physician.
Right.
Who's in charge of bodily health.
Right. And he says basically that the country roads are less fatiguing than the city streets, and that the city streets were where Lysias was, and that's why he's now walking the country. Meet Socrates in that particular place, and then, of course, you know, Socrates later on says, yeah, there's more to learn in the city, but there's a significance here to being in the country.
So. Well, and that's why I say if you're doing this dramatically, if we're not doing this like as a biography of Socrates, that Plato, if you think of him as a playwright, if this analysis is useful or correct, that Plato is putting Socrates in the country here because it represents better Socrates' preferred style of speaking, which is dialectic, which is improv. It's like word jazz, as opposed to walking in the city, which is pre-programmed in a kind of way like a set speech of rhetoric is.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that's the case, because it seems like the, you know, what Socrates later says seems to imply, you know, this idea that he can learn more from people in the city, that's where dialectic occurs. That's where you find people to have those exchanges. And with nature, you're all alone.
But the city-country contrast may be usefully symbolic of one of the issues at the heart of this particular dialogue.
Right. I'm wondering if what it's symbolic, though, of is the actual reading that occurs under the tree, right? And in fact, Phaedrus doesn't initially say, oh, I have a, look at, here's the written speech, let's read it. They go through this thing where Phaedrus acts like he heard Lysias speak, but he doesn't remember anything. He'd try and give Socrates the gist, and then Socrates notices that he has that, the whole written
thing. Something under his cloak.
And then they go to that particular tree to read it. So ultimately, I might agree with you in this, but my first impression was that what the country represents here is the written word and the unfatiguing approach, right? As opposed to the fatiguing dialectic of city streets. But I can be persuaded in the opposite.
Once you get a sense of what's at stake between dialectic and rhetoric, even at its best for Socrates, then you can have a sense of what could usefully be symbolic of it, which is kind of what we were just talking about with the Boreas incident. One other somewhat background issue worth having in mind here, which comes up in a number of the other dialogues, perhaps most famously in the beginning of the Apology, is the issue between speech that is convincing versus speech that is true. And the opening of the Apology goes on about this for a couple paragraphs, that the prosecution of Socrates has been very convincing. In fact, Socrates himself is almost carried away by it. But Socrates says, not a word that they spoke was true. And Socrates himself is only going to speak the truth without regard to whether it's quote-unquote convincing or not. And I think there's a deep philosophical issue and problem for Plato and Socrates here, which is, it's kind of astounding when you actually think about it, which is, how could the truth not be convincing to people? I mean, if you actually articulate the truth, how could somebody hear the truth and not find it convincing? And that's certainly the case in Socrates' trial, apparently. Or on the other hand, when we look at democracy, if you look at what goes on in a law court or an assembly or in Greek theater where they voted for prizes, everything depended on a vote. And the way you win a vote, whether it's with a jury or an assembly or judges at a theater, you win by being convincing. And this is what sets up this whole problem about how speech can be used, I think. And it's the issue that Socrates in this dialogue is trying to resolve with its idea that how do we have speech that can both be true and also convincing to the masses?
To the masses? Or does he really care about the masses? I thought one of the points of why written language is bad is because it is for the masses, whereas a speech you can pick and choose.
Yeah, that's for written speeches, but there's also the question of oral set speeches, which are not written but are nonetheless rhetoric. And Socrates' two speeches in the first half are examples of oral set speeches, whereas Lysias's is obviously an example of a written speech. They're similar, but they're not the same. And I think this issue of what the multitude, you know, we can get there later, but in the second half, Socrates, they go on for quite a bit about that the multitude is persuaded by what they find probable, regardless of what's actual. The multitude is moved by what's probable.
Yeah, under someone else's theory, yeah.
I thought the argument was that that was what rhetoricians used as their technique, that they argued based upon the probable.
In fact, one rhetorician in particular, whose name I forget, had that theory.
So. There's Theodorus and Thrasymachus.
But all of them, yeah, right.
Yeah, but I don't know if it went so far as to say that that's what actually persuades. I mean, the analysis of how you get persuaded, it was an analysis of the technique that the rhetoricians use. Now, maybe those go hand in hand.
Right, and ultimately the technique makes no sense because in order to figure out what's probable or what people think is probable, you have to know the truth or something like that.
A lot of the problem is very similar to the idea that if you know what the good is, then why wouldn't you do it? And so it could either be a question of you actually don't know what the good is, and so it's a question of education, or you do know what the good is, but you're incontinent with respect to it, and you haven't molded your soul properly so that you can act in that way.
Before we go further, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsors. First, I want to tell you about The Great Courses Plus. Many of you have already signed up for this great video learning service. You have unlimited access to over 7,000 fascinating video lectures taught by award-winning professors. But if you haven't signed up for The Great Courses Plus yet, now is the perfect time, since I have a special offer I'll tell you about shortly. The Great Courses Plus lets you learn about anything that interests you, philosophy, science, history, or even how to take better photos or play chess. You can watch these engaging online video lectures anytime, anywhere, using your TV, laptop, tablet, or smartphone. I've been watching their course, The Big Questions of Philosophy. It's a series of 36 lectures by Professor David K. Johnson of the University of Oklahoma. It covers all the major topics you'd expect, like what is truth? How does the brain produce the mind? Does reason define the good? How ought we to live? And so on. Most recently, I've been listening to Lecture 34, What Are the Limits of Liberty? This lecture is a thought-provoking look at John Stuart Mill's 1859 work On Liberty and how his reasoning about government can be applied to current hot-button topics like gay marriage, the legalization of marijuana, and the extent to which offensive and inflammatory speech should be legal. I know you'll love The Great Courses Plus, like I do. Sign up today, and as one of our podcast listeners, you'll immediately get 1 month free to start watching as many lectures as you want. And make sure to check out The Big Questions of Philosophy. To start your free trial today, sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL, and that's plus spelled out, P-L-U-S. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
This episode of The Partially Examined Life is also brought to you by Harry's. If you are a guy, you have got to shave. Whether you're old, young, bearded, or baby's bottom smooth, you've got to put the razor to your face at some point. And when you do, you should be using Harry's. You've heard me talk before about Harry's high-quality, high-performance German blades that have given me the best shave I've had in years. You know that with Harry's, you'll pay about half the price of leading brands, and get your blades and shaving gear shipped right to your doorstep. So listen, I've been sporting a hipster beard for a couple of years now, and although I keep it tight, I still have to shave on the cheeks and at the neckline. The latter is a real pain because my facial hair swirls, and I've got to shave down, up, and across to get a good close shave. Now, Harry's excellently sharp blades, shave cream, and aftershave ensure that I get that clean lines and smooth skin I'm looking for without irritation. Harry's lets me shave every day without discomfort, stubble, or burn. So I use most of Harry's products, and you can get started with their Truman set, a great option for new customers and an amazing deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle moisturizing shave cream and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, we have a special offer just for Partially Examined Life fans. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase when you visit harrys.com/PEL. That's harrys.com/PEL. Stop compromising. Give Harry's a try today.
So let's get back to it. We're about to talk about the first speech.
Lysias.
Is that a scroll you got in your pocket, or are you just glad to see
me? If I were glad to see you, it wouldn't be good for you.
So the thesis is pretty simple, which is love is irrational. That if you are in love, if you've fallen in love, then it's kind of a sickness. And you do things that later you regret, so that it's like, you're only doing this for me because you love me. Whereas if we were just friends, you would do things for me voluntarily or because I'm a decent person. And that's what friends do for each other. But if you're in love with me, then you're going to do all this stuff just because you want to get in my pants or whatever, because you're doting upon me. And that's going to fade. It's based on desire. That's going to fade. And you're going to regret that. It's just, you're not really being you when you're in love. So wouldn't you rather have someone who's really being themselves and being reasonable?
Yeah, really, but though this is looked at from the standpoint of the beloved, right? It's the beloved's calculation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's a matter of what's good or bad for the beloved. And so the question is whether or not a non-lover, whether the beloved should give their favors to the non-lover or to the lover. So I just wanted to say, what do we mean by the giving of favors? I mean, on the one level, it seems obviously giving into sexual advances, but maybe there's more to it than to that.
It's focusing on the person who's being importuned. It's focusing on the person who's the recipient of these acts of speaking and to figure out how to respond to these acts of speaking appropriately.
Very good.
The one who's being persuaded.
So in the more general rhetorical sense, it's about whether or not you accept someone's argument. But in the particular case of love, it's about, I suppose it could be, you know, it's about whether or not you accept their love or, you know, again, it's just this question of the giving of favors. And what that means.
But as Mark was getting to, the argument of the speech is that it's better to accept the advances of someone who doesn't love you.
Right.
Because
right.
The lover is mad and won't actually care for you. Because they'll be doing whatever they can do. In a funny way, it's an argument that the lover is merely being persuasive without being true.
Right.
Bingo. And I think all of this depends upon trying to get the beloved, the addressee of these speeches, about maximizing your own self-interest. What course of action should I follow here that will actually benefit me and not harm me?
Yeah. So Phaedrus finds the speech awesome, right?
Yes. And they describe Lysias as the ablest writer of the time. So, I mean, in a certain way, if you take down Lysias in this dialogue, Plato is taking down the best writer of his era.
Yeah. And Socrates himself admits that it was amazingly fine and he was thrilled by it.
The way the argument goes basically is that the lover is damaging to the beloved because they're jealous, they're smothering, they're controlling, they interfere with your friendships. If you need something from them once their passions go away, they won't give it to you. They flatter you in a way that's bad for your character. So I didn't know that we touched on that. So I just wanted to get that in there.
I think that's more of that stuff seems to be in Socrates' elaboration.
It's all in there.
Okay,
this is
here
based
too.
On my summary of this particular speech. So
let's just read a quote from here because we're talking about speaking style. We have to give some of the supposed speaking style attributed to Lysias here. I'm just picking sort of randomly. We have a point we haven't talked about yet, 233a. In addition, many of the lovers desire the body before they come to know the character and gain experience of the other personal traits, so that it's unclear to them whether they will still wish to be friends then when they have ceased from desire. But as for the non-lovers who were friends with each other even before they did these things, it is not likely that these things, through which they received benefit, should diminish friendship with them. But these things are left behind as reminders of those that are going to be. It is to be expected that you would become better by being persuaded by me rather than by a lover. For those people praise the sayings and doings even contrary to what's best, in some cases fearing lest they be hated, in other cases because their own knowledge is worse on account of desire. That's probably good enough. It's not exactly stirring. It's just kind of listing some reasons. Now, Socrates is pretty harsh on it. He says that really the sentences could have been given in any order, that it's highly redundant, that it's totally disorganized, and worse off, that he doesn't start off the dialogue by saying what love is. They read the intro to it several times, which the intro is just setting up the situation which the speech is being given. The speaker is saying, you know about my affairs and you have heard what, these things having come to be, I believe to be advantageous for us. And I deem it to be fitting to be spared the misfortune of not getting what I ask for on this account, that I do not happen to be in love with you. So that's about the least romantic proposal that you could possibly get.
Right.
It's the most stilted. It's saying, you should sleep with me, even though I'm telling you right now that I'm not in love with you. In fact, it's better that I'm not in love with you, that you sleep with me. So Socrates says, look, he's starting right there in the way he elaborates it. Would you rather be loved by the lover or the non-lover? Well, what is love? What does that actually mean? And just kind of characterizing it as he goes in the reasons that he gives. As Wes was saying, that the lover is going to try to be possessive. The lover is going to be jealous. Well, that's what love is. Love is being jealous and possessive.
Yeah, the definition he ultimately ends up giving for this. And by the way, this is just kind of, Mark, you've already revealed it, but the speech is much more structured, right, than Lysias' speech, even though it's saying exactly the same thing. So that's a kind of a lesson in rhetoric right there. But he starts off with that definition, or he builds towards it. And the definition we get is that this is around, it's 447 in the lobe, which is around 238 C or something. Yeah.
So this is right at the beginning of Socrates' speech.
You're overcome with desire of a particular sort. So there are different kinds of desire, like for food, for instance, and you're a glutton if you kind of give into the excess of that. Well, love is being overcome by a particular sort of desire that's directed at beauty, especially quote unquote personal beauty, which I take to be the beauty of a human being.
And what do you guys think of that as a definition
being,
of love?
Being love is being drawn towards beauty.
Or even his eventual definition that he actually likes, this one is not one that he's ultimately going to go with, still has to do with beauty. It has to do with fixation on beauty. I mean, what do you think of that just as, does love necessarily have to do with beauty?
Well, Socrates, in his long second speech, talks about that of all the forms that are out there, like truth, justice, and so on, it's beauty or goodness. It turns out that beauty is the one that's most palpable in the world that we live in, which is why it has a special place for us, that beauty and truth or goodness are all equally important concepts, but you can't sensorially experience truth or goodness the way you can sensorially experience beauty. And that's why it moves us more. It moves our bodies more because it's of the same realm.
And there's a reason why apps like Tinder involve just pictures and then a few words. Beauty is important to love. I mean, whether, you know, I think intuitively we understand that, whether it's physical beauty or what we might think of as beauty of the soul, I think at least intuitively and, you know, on a first glance, let's say, love at first sight, it's important.
I think it is said someone here that it's a matter of finding something beautiful. So it's not even a matter necessarily that the person is objectively beautiful. So therefore, someone who's not objectively beautiful will never have love, will never be loved. Like, that's not the way it works.
No.
The way he puts it, though, sounds almost like beauty is an objective thing. So, you know, again, at this 438C, I say that the desire which overcomes the rational opinion that strives towards the right and which is led away towards the enjoyment of beauty and, again, is strongly forced by the desires that are kindred to itself toward personal beauty, when it gains the victory, takes its name from that very force and is called love. And so, by the way, it's worth mentioning that he sets up this desire. He sets it up in opposition to what he variously calls acquired opinion. So cultural norms or rational opinion that strives toward the right. The things that we learned are good as opposed to simply following desire. So it sounds there like beauty is this objective thing and it's being blown away by it or having your desire overcome by it. That's the key point here. Not that it's just to each their own, that, you know, we might find anything beautiful that we like.
No, I think because the analogy is to like truth or goodness, which I think for Plato and Socrates are also objective and not subjective.
Yeah, and what do we make of this being the recapitulation of Lysias's speech, but better, right? This is the first speech, and it's intended to be, in some sense, Lysias's speech, right?
Lysias' speech revised. Socrates wears a veil while he's giving it because he can't stand.
Yeah, he's ashamed to be doing it. We're sort of talking about it like right now we're making links about how he's talking about love and stuff like that, which it may be that there's certain things that are in common all the way through both speeches and through to the end. But it is intended to be a argument for the same sort of thing that Lysias' argument was, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the one thing we get here is because we get a definition of love, we get a kind of causal theory. So there's a mechanism at work that we can apply in arguing for what the effects of the lover will be on the beloved. And then there's that structure, right? So we start out with the definition, then he's going to go on and say, look, here's how it affects, here's how the lover affects the virtue and the intellect of the beloved. It's not good. Here's how it affects masculinity. It's not good. They look for someone who's effeminate. The lover looks for someone who's effeminate or transforms them into that. And then here's, you know, the lover wants you not to have any possessions, basically, for various reasons. And they're generally unpleasant and they won't repay your favors when their love fades. So again, making many of the same points. And that's why Mark thought when I summarized Lysias' speech that it was Socrates' speech, because it is so similar in those points, but it's got a causal theory of why love does that, and it's got the structure, as far as I can see.
And Socrates explicitly brings up Ike Turner. So there you go.
And at the end, love is, I mean, the punchline, or I mean, the
punchline, so to speak.
The final, that love is bad and you shouldn't prefer the lover because it will cause you not to behave properly, right?
You mean the end of Socrates' first speech?
End of Socrates' first speech, the one that's supposed to be like Lysias.
241D.
Yep.
He says at the conclusion, let that then, my boy, be your lesson. Be sure that the attentions of a lover carry no goodwill. They are no more than the glutting of his appetite for, and then he quotes his proverb, as wolf to lamb, so lover to his lad.
I don't want to eat you up.
Well, and I think, you know, both with Lysias and Socrates' first speech is that the argument essentially is that the interests of the lover and the beloved are mutually exclusive, and that that's a problem for the beloved.
Right.
So as a point of rhetoric, just to go back to the definition there, I think that while Socrates acknowledges that definitions of this kind of thing are going to be controversial, I got to think that giving the definition at the beginning, it's supposed to be stating a premise that will be agreeable to everyone. And ultimately, even he, in the later speech that he gives, that has diametrically opposed conclusions to this, is still going to agree that what love is being overwhelmed by desire in some way.
For the beautiful, not just any kind of desire.
Yes, exactly. For the beautiful. And the question is that bad? And in this whole speech, yes, of course it's bad. So his second speech is going to say, well, being overwhelmed, being driven mad, there are actually some good kinds of madness.
Yeah.
And, you know, has to give this whole big, long cosmological picture, you know, examples of other kind of madness and this cosmological picture, and then ultimately this allegorical picture of how this madness enables a harmony of the soul in a way that didn't come out in the Republic, say. You know, we've got the rational part of the soul, you've got the spirited part of the soul, you've got the irrational part of the soul. It sounded like in the Republic, the rational part should just rule. End of story. And in this one, well, no, being overwhelmed, having love, having something that kind of gives a little freedom to the desire part, gives a role for it, sublimates it in some way, is going to end up being good. But again, for the rhetorical point, the point about the style of the speech, I think that the definition there at the beginning is supposed to be just, oh, everybody agrees with this, right?
Well, I think
no.
Socrates makes the point at 265D that the definition just given of love may be right or wrong. So he's not even necessarily affirming it. In fact, he's never really affirming the truthiness of most of what he said. But he says, at all events, it was that which enabled our discourse to achieve lucidity and consistency. So he's had this little passage talking about there's two kinds of words out there. There's some words like silver and iron where everybody automatically agrees what they mean. but there's other words where the meanings seem to fluctuate or there's no consensus. Even a single person doesn't necessarily agree with himself time after time about what truth or goodness or something like that is. And so he says, especially those words that fluctuate need to be defined at the beginning of your discourse or even of a dialectic, because otherwise you'll get to the end and you'll realize you and the person you're speaking to were thinking of different things and you've just wasted all your time. So you've got to nail down those fluctuating words at the beginning.
What do you think of that? Because as a point of philosophy, like, I think a lot of times people even have commented on this podcast, well, you didn't just define your terms at the beginning. And I would usually use Socrates as the example why you don't do that, because the terms themselves are exactly what is at issue. And if you're asking about transhumanism or mind or artificial intelligence or something like that, the whole point of the discussion is to work toward, in some one of the points of the discussion, what that might be. And a lot of times you just, okay, well, this is something, you know, that, so we got this specifically about God. Arguments for the existence of God. Well, don't you have to, at the beginning of that podcast, define what God is, and then you can decide whether what arguments there are for his existence or whether these work? But no, it seems much better that since God is a pervasive notion in the culture, that we just kind of go on that shared vague understanding. And if we spend too much time trying to sharpen that, then we never get to anything else.
Right. Mino's problem. But I mean, a definition can just be establishing what that vague understanding is before we proceed, so that we know what we're assuming and we know.
Well, and I think this also comes down to, you know, what's the object of the exercise in reading a book like this? Because, I mean, on one level, this book is about whatever it's about, and whatever it's about may or may not be applicable to other kinds of problems. But I take it that, you know, Socrates, again, at like 266b and following, you know, he's talking about that one of the things that's come out of these specimens that he's given is these complementary procedures of definition and division, and that the process of bringing many into one with definition, or taking one and cutting it up at its joints, so to speak, so that you can figure out the types of things, that these complementary procedures are at the heart of dialectic, which I take it for Socrates is the most fabulous thing in the whole universe, in this dialogue. And actually, if you look at Socrates' two speeches, my own opinion actually is that they're not separate speeches. They're actually two halves of a common speech, and that the first speech does the definition of love, which serves for both halves of the speech. And the two parts of the speech are the division. Speech number one deals with the lover who's smitten by human madness, and speech number two deals with the lover who's smitten by divine madness. What Socrates says at 266a, so that essentially, and I know, you know, we're living so long ago, but I mean, it's like Plato and Socrates have just discovered the tree, that you can draw a tree on the blackboard and you have a common term at the top and you can put two subterms. Like, how cool is that? I can go down the left side. I can go down the right side. And the problem with Socrates' first speech is not that it's false. It's not false. It's actually true. The problem is it's incomplete. That's why it's kind of an oratorical trick. It leaves you thinking that something is the case because it has not finished the argument by going down the right side of the tree of divine madness.
Right.
But you could still ask when you're done, is the kind of possessive character that is described in the first Lysias type speech that Socrates gives, is that really love? And I would think that reading the rest of the dialogue, you would say, well, no, that's not really love. If you really love someone, you don't put them in a box. You don't belittle them. You don't try to possess them. Real love is, you know, this elevating thing that Socrates then goes on to talk about.
And if they don't come back. But I think this is now another instance of this notion of division. Just like there's two kinds of madness, human madness and divine madness, I take it that in the dialogue, there's really two kinds of love, and they're both real. It just turns out that the human kind of love, or the bodily kind of love, is pernicious for the beloved, but that the divinely inspired love, or the soulful kind of love, is beneficial for the beloved. And therefore, knowing the difference between the two makes all the difference.
You're a divine lover, Mark.
I'm just having trouble with this as a... He's the guy that came up with the dialectic, so I can't really argue that this is not historically what he did in other dialogues, and maybe I should look at the other dialogues more closely for the example of that. But it seems like if he's in some of the other dialogues, he doesn't just say, What is justice? Here I'm going to tell you what justice is in the first page. And then for the rest of it, we're going to kind of explore that.
Well, no, the Republic starts just like that. He asks what justice is, and he starts with Cephalus's definition of justice.
Right. He tests out different ones.
Yeah, yeah.
And he rejects them. But what he's doing here, what he's saying you should do, is just give one. And no, that's what, according to Adam's analysis, that's what holds for the rest of the thing. You don't revise it.
There is a sort of argument, right, to this definition of love, right? It builds up. He says, everyone desires a beautiful, so that's not a basis for distinguishing the lover from the non-lover. And so then he has to get at that basis. So it's not just desire for the beautiful is what love is. Then he gets at this division between the acquisitions of culture and acquired opinion, and then the innate desires and pleasures. So, you know, id and superego, let's say. And the conflict between those two and the ways in which desire can overcome acquired opinion and lead us to do things which other people or even ourselves might disapprove of. And then that's what love becomes. I just wanted to point that out because it's not like we just simply stipulate the definition of love. We start with these other considerations and then build to it.
But I think there's also another point based on what Mark is saying, and it kind of goes to my issue about whether we treat these dialogues as philosophical dramas. Because once you put it into the realm of drama and that these are works of Plato rather than necessarily historical accounts about Socrates, in the first instance, there's no reason to assume that Plato as author is doing the same thing in each of the dialogues, any more than saying that Shakespeare is doing the same thing in each of his plays, that each one could have its own purpose, and therefore what the character Socrates does or doesn't do in any given dialogue may be connected to what that particular dialogue is about. But I'd also go one step further, that a lot of the dialogues where Socrates is focused on defining things like, you know, meno, you know, what is virtue and all the rest of that stuff, I mean, it shows the importance that that's actually what happens in Meno all the time, that Meno can't be bothered to wait for the definition of virtue. He wants to go on to find out how it's acquired. And Socrates says, I understand your interest. You know, it's important to figure out how virtue is acquired. But unfortunately, we can't actually do that until we first figure out what it is. And if we don't figure out what it is in our lifetime or the next 100 years, that's too bad on us. We can't do the next step.
Yeah. If we want to tackle the, you know, the dialectic in the sense of watching him go through the breaking apart and pulling together, I mean, he talks about that here after the speeches on love, but we would want to go through like the Sophist or something like that, where he just wanders down that tree that Adam was talking about and goes, you know, down one side, then goes back up and goes down the other side, and then talks about the activity of going up and down the tree.
So before we wrap up the first half here, let's just talk about the transition between his two speeches, where the daemon comes back that he's talked about in several of his dialogues.
Well, first, he ends it, and Phaedrus says, well, it sounds like you were still in the middle of that. That's not the end. What about the non-lover? Because he only really talks about the lover. And then Socrates says, that'll work me up into too much of a passion to talk about that. So don't compel me. Don't put some further compulsion on me, he says in my translation. And basically, Phaedrus begs, calls him a superhuman with regard to giving speeches. And that's when you get to the daimon part.
Well, yeah. And since you're bringing that up, I mean, he had said before he started his first speech that pretty much stop me if I go into poetry. And he does go into poetry with his last line of the speech.
Yeah. And he says that he's about to break out into epic verse, you know, that it's getting so long.
Yeah. And in fact, there's an interlude in between the definition of love. And then he goes on to the rest of the first speech where he asks Phaedrus how he's doing and that he's divinely inspired. And Socrates says that he's speaking dithyrambically. And so that makes it even more sensible that Socrates tries to beg off again after he's done with that first speech, saying that I'm on the verge of madness as it is. And
I will be manifestly possessed by the nymphs if I keep going, if I talk any more here. So what does this mean in terms of part of his dismissal of rhetoric is connected with his dismissal of poetry? We saw in the Republic that poetry is generally corrupting. It's a mere imitation. It's not the truth. And he puts poets kind of low on his list of, you know, who's the most virtuous. But can we draw any other conclusions from the particular use here? And I don't want to become a poet. I better stop now. Or is this just goofing around? Tell us something significant, given that this whole thing is about rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, the sense in which each of these speeches is, he's joking that they're manifestations of this divine madness, which is a form of love.
And your question, I think, is just complicated. I mean, as Adam was talking from the beginning, that, and Wes brought this up as well, that on the one hand, you have this indictment of rhetoric, and you have this indictment of poetry, both as we remember from the Republic, but also even here, the way in which he's accusing himself of speaking poetically. Yet, Socrates regularly refers to myths here and in other speeches. He also speaks very persuasively and speaks about how to speak persuasively. So there's this kind of tension with, on the one hand, dismissing poetry and dismissing rhetoric, but on the other hand, pointing towards the right kind of divine madness and the right kind of persuasive speech.
Right.
And so
exactly.
it's not as simple as saying that those things are wrong. In fact, in some ways, both of them are incredibly important, speaking persuasively and also being divinely inspired. But doing so in the right way is what makes the whole difference.
Yeah, the right kind of rhetoric is connected to love, as in the divine madness sort of love.
Yes.
And the written word is essentially the non-lover. The whole lover versus non-lover thing is also just a metaphor for the difference between the right kind of rhetoric and the wrong kind of rhetoric slash the written word.
Yes.
The written word is the non-lover.
If I could just say a couple things to that point before we move on. So one, I think in this dialogue in particular, the fact that Socrates is breaking out into poetry is itself a sign that Socrates has been divinely possessed. It's not even clear that Socrates is actually the author of the speeches that he's delivering. In fact, when they're talking dialectically later on, Socrates has to ask Phaedrus, did I define love at the beginning of my first speech? I don't remember. And so if we take that at face value, I mean, one of the things about Plato's Socrates is that he's continually presented as on a mission from God to Athens, and that this is yet another instance that Socrates is genuinely in connection with the divine. And the second thing is, in terms of this thing about, you're talking about the Republic and trashing poetry or trashing rhetoric and the other things, I want to just make two points about this. One is, if you take this dramatic approach to Plato's dialogues, then the first thing that comes out of that is that Plato spent his whole life being a poet, that he wrote poetry. So we have to really take that into account. And second of all, I really take it that in the Republic and in the Gorgias and even here, the argument ultimately is not against rhetoric per se or poetry per se. It's against bad rhetoric and bad poetry. And that, if I can use that image from the Republic about the philosopher king, that, you know, not until philosophers become kings or kings become philosophers are we going to have justice in our city. The argument is essentially the same for rhetoric and for poetry. Not until poets become philosophers or philosophers become poets, or similarly, not until rhetoricians become philosophers or philosophers become rhetoricians. But I take it that Plato in his own life and the Phaedrus as a dialogue are both affirming the possibility, albeit it's very difficult, but the possibility, indeed the necessity, of having philosopher rhetoricians and having philosopher poets. And I take it that actually Plato spent his whole life being a philosopher poet.
Right. And pretty clearly the early stuff is ironic, you know, where he's saying, oh, I don't want to get too worked up and become too poetic. I mean, pretty clearly he's endorsing divine madness when it comes to rhetoric and persuasion and love and all of that stuff. So
you might say his critique is kind of like we recently had an Adorno episode, that poetry, and you know, this would extend to other art forms, representational art forms, is propagandistic. And the question is just, well, what is trying to be conveyed? And if the propaganda, if the message, if the way that it is attempting to mold the listener is driven by truth and the vision of good that Plato has in mind, then that's exactly what you should be using rhetoric for. That is what a rhetorician philosopher is somebody that is doing that manipulation of the subject. But is it really manipulation? Because you're imparting them with truth. No, you're improving them. You're not manipulating them. That sounds bad. But if you're ignorantly spouting things or self-consciously lying, either one of those things, those would obviously be abuses of the art form.
Right. If you know the truth and you're trying to lead people in that direction, you can use the art of persuasion. That seems to be the suggestion in this dialogue. Those techniques are legitimate as long as they are used with knowledge and with the goal of imparting, bringing people to knowledge.
You wouldn't have to just be lying, though, right? You could be trying to persuade them of something that just wasn't for their own good. You wouldn't have to lie to them to do that, but you could be trying to persuade something that was bad for them. Now, that might fall in the category of not being against the truth or something like that.
But even in the case of persuading someone of the truth, you can appeal to their emotions. You can use all sorts of rhetorical tricks, which have nothing to do with the truth of what you're saying, in order to attract them to something that happens to be true. So that's the kind of...
Well, and we're given an example of that in this dialogue, because Socrates says that the combined speech that he gave was designed specifically to be suitable for Phaedrus's soul.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not even a universal statement of cosmic reality or love or anything. It's the particularly tailored statement that will work for this particular addressee.
Well, that seems like a good place to stop, and let's start with the daemon next week and talk about that positive account of love in more detail and all the myths and stuff that go into it, and finish up with a bit about rhetoric. So folks, if you don't want to wait, go become a Partially Examined Life citizen at partiallyexaminedlife.com, and you can get the Citizen Edition, which has our whole discussion, which we're all just having right now. So you might as well listen to the whole thing in one sitting too. But otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thanks.